Accession copy number 9378, reel 4.
Vice Marshal Bennett, reel 4.
Dresden is a name that is produced by arrangement with a bunch of communists in Berlin to make out that we went to trouble to bomb women and children. Well, we didn't waste bombs on women and children. We bombed Dresden, and this is typical of propaganda warfare. We bombed Dresden because it was a prime target on that night. We were called during the day by the Russians, who particularly called for a raid on Dresden with everything we've got, because troops were pouring through Dresden. There were something like 80,000 at the time, on their way to the Russian front, only a very short distance away, something less than 100 miles. The Russians were being held up by these troop reinforcements. Could we help? And at short notice, we were put on to Dresden, which we bombed perfectly normally. The fact that it caught fire rather easily was the Germans' fault. They had no air raid precautions, and they didn't believe in building anything other than wooden aeroplanes, wooden residences in Dresden. They also happened to have the German civil service in Dresden more than anywhere else. They'd moved them there out of Berlin for safety. So we did do some heavy bombing, and the next day the Americans did a raid and we did another one. Now, okay, a lot of people got killed. We were off bombing of other parts which we didn't like, but we did stop the troops getting to the Russian front at a critical moment, and the Russians expressed their thanks to us for that purpose. Now, that's the sort of thing which we did with anti-British propaganda following. And today we have many people in this country who believe that we were cruel, horrible people bombing Dresden. Now, after all, it wasn't even a military target. Of course, it was a military target, and it was vitally important to the Western, to the Russian front, the Eastern front, on that particular day. We also, of course, were diverted from strategic bombing by a thing I mentioned, namely the buzz bombs. During the tail end of the war, 1944, we had this sudden attention of secret weapons, and Hitler produced at Peenemünde, which we disposed of separately as a separate issue, but we had buzz bombs, V1s, and rockets, V2s, laid on to destroy the whole of the south of England, where most of the people were. Most of our population were in the south of England. We immediately laid on bombing of the buzz bomb launching sites, of which there were several hundred, and the launching sites were busy squirting off their buzz bombs one after another as hard as they could go, and we had to, in daylight, go out and destroy them, which we did fairly effectively. The most effective thing of all was a little matter of a dump at a place called Wharton, W-A-T-T-E-N, where we destroyed 10,000 buzz bombs in one night. Now, had we not done so, those buzz bombs would have been released on the south of England within a matter of a week or so, and destroy them on site as much as you would, we couldn't have stopped most of the 10,000 getting through. And 10,000 people, all within 50 miles of London or on London, would have lost us the war, but not the faintest shadow of doubt. And that was a little diversion of Bomber Command. Not much mentioned, hardly at all.
Do you know when that was?
I could look it up for you, but I haven't got it in my mind. And also, Peenemünde had the rockets, V2s, the ones that went up and came vertically down. They call it Star Wars now. And the Star Wars of those days were being implemented by the best boffins the Germans could produce. We were tipped off by some Poles who told us that this was coming, and so we laid on the Peenemunde raid. Lord Chauvel had me in his office on this on a number of occasions. As soon as we heard of them, long before air staff had heard of them, it was Chauvel, Churchill and myself to start with, we had a problem. How do you stop a vertical rocket coming down? And I'm pleased to say that we all agreed that the only way to stop them was ab initio, in other words, on the ground before they started, because we could never hope to stop them on a vertical dive at whatever it was, 2,000 knots, whatever you did. And so we laid on the Peenemunde raid with John Searby as master bomber. He was one of our leading pathfinders. And I have a tape of that to this day, of what he said about that raid. Anyway, that stopped that. But again, a diversion of effort, the whole command hitting this one target. So that if people want to judge the strategic value of a heavy bomber force, they must remember that the strategic strength was wasted to a large extent on other things. And although I don't blame people for it, it's to be remembered in evaluating the results, that's all. Of course, we had other things. When the invasion got near, we had to bomb all the marshalling yards in Western Europe. And I can't remember it. I think, roughly speaking, we had to do 6 yards which were not on the invasion sites for every one that was. In other words, we had to deliberately put off the Hun by apparently attacking elsewhere. And then when that was done, the invasion itself came along, and pathfinders, being the leaders of the heavies, the only people who were really any good in terms of weight, I had to give a guarantee, for example, to the naval representatives on the planning committee that I would sink every barge carrying troops, because every barge every barge would be subject to being sunk if it were not for the fact that we had silenced the batteries ashore which were aiming at them. There were these big 16-inch guns. I can't remember again the figures. I think it was 12 per battery, and there were about 10 batteries. And we had to silence all those guns to stop them sinking the barges carrying about 100 people. One shell would sink one. We had to give a guarantee that this would not happen. In other words, we would so effectively deal with the coastal batteries, and we were not allowed to touch them more than 6 hours before the invasion, just to make life easy. And I gave that guarantee. And my guarantee was only conditional upon one thing, that is that if the weather is good enough for the Navy, it's good enough for us to get the coastal batteries. And I'm pleased to say it worked out. As you may remember, you were there at the time, weren't you? We had a full night's delay. We were held up 24 hours. Eisenhower delayed 24 hours, and it's just as well, because we were better able to... You see, we had to see for this job, because although I could hit the batteries with my oboe, the main force had to see the markers we put down. And I'm pleased to say they did, and they did destroy them. There was one gun firing out of the whole lot at the time. And so the invasion was possible, and they all got ashore with relatively small casualties, practically no casualties. Casualties were later on. The most notable one, worth mentioning, is the Americans. We had to do the whole lot, of course, but the Americans had a particular responsibility for Omaha Beach, and they made an appalling mistake. They went ashore and they dug in. Well, you can't dig in a sandy beach. with a 88mm firing along the length of the beach. And the massacre was the worst ever. I think they lost, what was it, whole division, actually. And all the time this was going on, naturally I knew about it because I was in touch all the time, and I tried to get them to agree to let me take out the battery that was causing the havoc. It was an 88mm, very easy thing to do. Oh, it's in concrete, you'll never do it. I said, look, let me try. I don't have to even hit the concrete. If I put a hail of 2,000 pounders or 1,000 pounders on it, plaster it, nobody in that bunker's going to shoot again for months. They didn't understand bombs at all. Anyway, they wouldn't allow it, and the bunker is still there to this day, and thousands of lives were lost simply because they wouldn't let us. You see, what I would have done is put down oboe marking, back it up with TIs, ordinary markers, and then come in with the HE, and I'm sure we could have stopped that thing within a half an hour of it starting, instead of which it went on for 12 hours, I think it was, and slaughtered the lot. And the Omaha Cemetery is the biggest cemetery in Europe. So, I know, I went there. For the 25th anniversary, we went to northern France, and de Gaulle led it on in a big way, and we went to one cemetery after another, and then we went to the Palace of Versailles for a big dinner, and they did appreciate what we'd done. But nobody else even knows we did it. So,
what about Arnhem? Did you have anything to do with the...
That's another case of army stupidity. I'm not being personal. I mean, it's understandable that mistakes should be made. In the case of Arnhem, they put them forward, they crossed the bridge, under Montgomery, who was generally a very good general. But having got over, they couldn't cross the next bridge. As you know, it was being held very heavily, including armoured, quite a lot of armoured stuff, and they couldn't advance. And they were running out of ammunition themselves and hadn't got this, that, and the other. And I wanted to drop supplies to them and extra men. And Montgomery withdrew instead. He said, oh no, it would be too dangerous dropping anything near our own troops. We wouldn't dream of doing that. It's just plain silly. We could put it, as I pointed out at the time, we could put it down to a matter of, 50 yards if he wanted it. And we could drop both food and ammunition. And also, we could bomb the armored tanks that were stopping them. He wouldn't allow any of it. It was too risky. We were too close. He didn't understand. He didn't want to. And that was a calamity. That was one of the worst calamities of all.
But why didn't he accept the advice of an expert?
There's no such thing as an expert to Montgomery, except Montgomery. You can put that in your pipe and smoke it. No, he was a good general in many ways, but he would not accept advice, least of all from Air Force officers. He even went berserk against us because we made his own troops go through bomb craters which we had created and thereby stopped his advance. The bomb craters being where the enemy was, and we had routed him. Things like that. And he never in his book ever gave us any credit for any of the major raids which we did to help the advance of his army. And I'm not being rude, but he was so self-centered. On the other hand, to give him his due, he did one masterful stroke during the Ardennes offensive. As you know, we advanced up towards Belgium with the British and Canadian troops. The Hun came down from the Ardennes in a straightforward thrust towards the coast, intending to get to the coast. They ran out of petrol by the time they got down on the river and had to stop. This would have cut off Montgomery, who was further north. Montgomery did a wonderful move, withdrawing like flight, almost like lightning. I've never known the army move so quick. They came back, retreated, and fortunately for him, we also happened to stop the German advance, because although there was thick fog and no aircraft could fly, 4 Group and 6 Group in the north were both in clear air. Pathfinders could operate on Fido, which we had developed ourselves, and we put mosquito markers on the St. Vith crossroads. St. Vith, V-I-T-H, it's worth knowing, because the St. Vith crossroads was the one place that all the armoured supplies had to come through. All the petrol had to come down to the tanks through that crossroad, and we stopped it. We stopped it in what appeared to be foggy conditions. We used coloured smoke as markers, and we had these heavies from 4 Group and 6 Group to back us up, and we stopped them completely. And the Hun tanks down on the river were unable to fire a shot. And so Montgomery was able to recover, and with the help of the 3rd Division American Army, they fought back and massacred a lot of Germans, and the situation was saved. But Montgomery's speed of action in coming back to counter the Rundstedt offensive was really masterful.
Which was the most frustrating time for you with Pathfinders then?
Most frustrating? Oh, undoubtedly the Berlin series. 16 raids, when Churchill had told them that there would be 16 raids, in effect. In other words, he told them everything, and I couldn't get off for one night to swing the changes, and I had to have surprise to be able to keep my casualties down. Churchill would not allow it. Bert Harris said he was doing his best to convince him otherwise. I don't know how hard he tried, but I was not in touch with Churchill, but I don't think it would have made any difference. He was determined, which was very sad. I lost 1.5 times my entire strength. I think that went out. 150% casualties. So,
what do you think was your proudest time with the Pathfinders?
I would say the proudest time was Hamburg. We destroyed Hamburg in 1 week with the low casualties and very effective. We stopped the submarine production of the German Navy almost entirely. Not entirely, but 40% of the production was stopped completely, straight away, and all the others were hindered. It was one of the most marvellous. And we could have taken Hamburg with a Boy Scout patrol at that time. They were so shaken. One example of cooperation between Bomber Command and the other services was at Le Havre. This is a port very strongly occupied by German troops, and one day we were rung up and said, could we put on a major blitz to get rid of all these people? They were being a nuisance. So we put on quite a heavy raid, and we put down markers at various points in the port area and places where we wanted to get rid of them. And during the early morning part of the planning, I was asked if I could deal with some batteries up on the coast, because the batteries were going to fire at the good ship Erebos. Now, the good ship Erebos was a gunboat, a very ancient monument, and a gunboat must be respected. So I said, yes, of course, we'd lay it on. So we laid on 100 training aircraft, each one carrying, I think it was 1,000-pound HE. And they went in on that nice Sunday afternoon. I watched it all myself. I went over in a mosquito. And they plastered these batteries with high explosive, and the batteries were duly silenced. The good ship Erebos then came within range, being unable to do so before because the range of the Erebos were less than the range of the batteries. So the good ship Erebos came in after the batteries were silenced and shelled half. The next morning, the good British press, dutiful to the end, banner headlines right across the front page, Royal Navy shells Le Havre. And at the bottom right-hand corner, there was a little piece about 1 inch that said, heavy bombers also attacked Le Havre. And that was the war. That was typical of the war. I don't blame them for getting Erebus mentioned. It's the only use they had for it. But it's typical of the press and the public relations of Great Britain to completely misinterpret the contributions made.
But was that because of a general bias towards the Navy in Britain?
Oh, yes. Britain is still, to this day, a naval country. I've had a letter today saying, don't put an Air Force memorial at Plymouth. Plymouth is a naval city. 1986.
Can you tell me about the Met flights that you conducted?
Yes, the Met flight was a very small unit, but a very important one. It was equipped with mosquitoes, and it was available for me to send out, or for that matter anybody else, to send out what we called a Pampa, which was the code name for a flight. We'd send out a Pampa and say, go round Berlin and come back and tell us what you found. We would get weather reports through the Met flight all over Germany, all over Europe, whenever we wanted them. And the casualty rates were very low, so one was not asking too much to ask them to do a flight. And we did it by day or by night, as required. And the information was vitally important, not only to pathfinders themselves, but to other associated activities. And the Met flight was never fully recognized. We had really a wonderful unit there serving the whole of the Royal Air Force.
How many people did it involve? How many did it involve?
Oh, a very small. It was one flight. It was usually of the order of 6 or 8 pilots and perhaps a dozen machines available at any time. They also used to lend me an aeroplane when I wanted one. They were very, very useful. And some of their people, like Michael Birkin, I can't remember all the names, but they were doing a very good, unobtrusive job. That was the Met flight. Mind you, there were many people unobtrusive. One of the most obvious ones is Lord Charwell, ex-Professor Lindemann. He was a member of the War Cabinet, and as such was the scientist in charge of scientific propositions for Churchill's benefit. In fact, he backed up Churchill and did his scientific thinking for him throughout the whole of the Churchill War period. His knowledge of science was a leading member, and he was the real strength behind the Pathfinder Force, because I had access to him at any hour of the day and night. He lived in number 11 Downing Street and had an open door to me, either in person or by phone. And if things were going wrong or if something was vitally important, I was able to take advantage of his help or perhaps even advice. And many subjects of terribly important proportions, like the V1s and V2s, particularly V2s, I would discuss with him. And we sorted out the difficulties of Star Wars in 1944, long before anybody else had worried about it at all. Charwell was the man responsible, and he was the scientist for the whole of the British war effort. Not always understood by the public, or even appreciated that he made these major decisions. But from the Pathfinder point of view, he was absolutely vital. I only wish we could thank him.
What was he like personally?
A very quiet, very, very quiet old man, rather slow, not slow mentally, but speaking slowly and deliberately. He used to come up to Dr. Rowe's office at what we call the Sunday Soviets at Malvern College, where all the big scientists would attend, and nearly always Lord Charwell would attend and be prominent, not actually taking the chair, which was done by Rowe, but sitting beside him and helping, guiding, and sometimes putting in their place people who needed it. He was a great influence and a very mild one. The fact that he disagreed with one or two other scientists was unfortunate, and nearly always when I heard about it, he was in the right and the other scientists were in the wrong. And they were sometimes in the wrong, in quite a big way. But Charwell never got credit for what he did, in my view, and should have done. And so, of course, the same applies to Dr. Rowe, who was in charge of a great Malvern. He should have had a much bigger chunk of recognition if we could have arranged it. But there we are.
Some people seem to have resented Lindemann's influence on Churchill.
Well, yes, I think some of them did, but the main ones that resented him were people who had opposite views on matters of opinion. The classic case being this question of, do you believe in area bombing or pinpoint bombing? Of course, everybody believes in pinpoint bombing, but you can't do it, so you don't do it. You can't hit a pinpoint on the far side of Germany on a dark knife with spoofs and dummies and diversions and everything. You hit what you can when you can. And I would say that Charles was a realist, and the other scientists were just impractical idealists. And they were quite wrong. But they didn't like it that Charwell was able to influence Churchill, and they were not. I think that's the explanation there.
We haven't mentioned Charles Portal.
Well, he, of course, was the chief of the air staff during the whole of the period of Pathfinder operations. And as such, he overcame the initial opposition to the Pathfinder idea. In fact, he created Pathfinders. He overruled Bert Harris and insisted upon having Pathfinders, and to that extent I'm very grateful. But we never had very much close contact with him, and indeed I finished up with the unhappy fact that he told me not to publish a book I'd written, and I had to say no because it had already been published. He never forgave me for that, but I'm pleased to say that even after that event, he did me the honour of coming and acting as the chairman of a meeting in the Albert Hall in support of the United Nations, which I organised. So he managed to be good to me, even when we disagreed over a little matter. The little matter being a brief, very brief autobiography. But his influence was there all the time, and the air staff people knew that they could resort to him and get support on anything to do with Pathfinders, and that, of course, was tremendously valuable to me.